Welcome to the Scotland Grows Show, the podcast partner of Scotland Grows magazine, which celebrates everything that is good in Scottish gardening, as we join gardeners around the country, picking up tips, plant recommendations and stories along the way. I'm MT O'Donnell, publisher of Scotland Grows magazine, and your host for this adventure. My first guest in this series is Dougal Phillip, who has been running a garden centre for 45 years, the first 20 in the walled garden at Hopetoun House, and since then at New Hopetoun Gardens. In his illustrious career, Dougal has been president of the UK Horticultural Trades Association, a vice president of the Royal Horticultural Society, chair of their shows committee, and is a senior garden judge at the RHS Flower Shows. He was chair of Perennial, the Gardener's Royal Benevolent Fund, until 2022, and is still on the garden committees for two of their gardens. And he is currently a director of Discover Scottish Gardens and chair of the trustees of Scotland's Garden Scheme. We are launching Series 5 with another horticultural legend. This series of the Scotland Grows Show is sponsored by Roots, a subscription from National Trust for Scotland, which celebrates Scotland's flora in the form of a roots pack sent to you every 6 weeks, containing Scottish seeds to grow at home for £6 a month. Sign up today at nts.org.uk/roots and use the code GROWS24 to receive an extra packet of seeds in your first delivery. Now let's dig into our chat with Dougal Phillip. Dougal, welcome to the Scotland Grows Show. I am so delighted that you have managed to make time to be with us and chat with us today, because you have been and you continue to be one of the busiest people in the horticultural industry.
Well, not really. You know, I'm sort of semi-retired now, but I only work 3 days at the garden centre a week and no weekends. After 45 years of working weekends, it's a real treat.
Well, that would imply that you then spend the rest of your time doing nothing, but we will dig into all of the things that you're involved in the horticultural industry. But let's go back then to the start of your career. What made you want to pursue a career in horticulture? Was that a deliberate choice, or did you feel you fell into it?
No, it was deliberate, I think. I always assumed I would become a publisher of maps, which is what my father did. And I went to St Andrews University and took geographical studies. But in my last 2 years there, I discovered landscape analysis and studying landscape, and followed that and found out you could be a landscape architect. But I failed to get on the postgraduate course at Edinburgh, 2 years running. In the meantime, I've started to get experience. I just advertised as a landscape gardener. And I discovered that people wanted to believe in you and they trusted you. And you learnt on the job. Everyone was writing books about plants and gardening and how to run a business. So it was quite easy to train yourself. But of course, if you made a mistake in someone's garden, you'd have to put it right at your own expense. So it was quite a steep learning curve, you know, and I hope I only ever made one mistake, or made a mistake once and didn't do that again. and then I was landscape gardening and thought, well, actually, if I break an arm or a leg, you know, what am I going to do? So I needed something to manage. And the opportunity came up to lease the walled garden at Hopetoun House in South Queensferry. And my plan to the trustees was that I would run the walled garden from the profits of a garden centre there. And well, I was only 25 and they took a big risk, but that's what we did. And I was there for 20 years.
What a baptism of fire then into the industry.
Yeah, well, I knew nothing about retailing, nothing about running a walled garden, but you do learn quickly.
And that has gone on. And obviously you have been at New Hopetoun Gardens for 45 years. So tell us a wee bit about how that grew.
Well, we had the first 20 years at the walled garden, and then our lease ran was finished and we had to find somewhere else to move. What we had fantastic staff. We had great customers, but we didn't have anywhere to do it. And in fact, we eventually, with only 13 months to go, found that the present site, which was like 2.5 miles closer to all our customers than the walled garden. And everyone said to us, oh, you never get planning permission and build it and be able to open in 13 months. But well, we didn't have any choice because we had nowhere to go at the end of that time. And so we did manage. A few customers said, well, we won't come to the new place because it won't be nice, not like the old one. And we even had someone after 10 years turned up and was amazed at how lovely it was. And I said, well, it's very kind of you to support us after 10 years.
10 years.
Yeah, but that's the way it goes. And actually, the model at New Hopeton Gardens is based on what we did at the Wall Garden. And we had the buildings in the middle. We liked having a couple of buildings, which we had at the Wall Garden. So we had two buildings, and after 5 years, we put the third one in, which we couldn't afford to begin with. And the buildings get people right to the back of the site. And then the selling area for plants is around the buildings in the middle. It's quite an expensive model to run because, you know, a lot of garden centres are a bit like a supermarket, you know, whereas we've got these gardens that people can wander around with. And I suppose our principle was to get our customers to be inspired by what we were doing, to entertain them and also educate them without them feeling they were being talked down to or educated. Because if they don't get a plant to grow properly, they'll often blame themselves and won't try again. So it's incredibly important to us that they have success first time, every time.
So coming along to see demonstration gardens allows people to see the plants in situ and to see nice planting combinations. So they hopefully take that with them to their own gardens.
Yeah. So that's always been our principle. And it also teaches the staff what plants look like, because, you know, they all come in about the same size and the same size of pots. And, you know, some stay like little alpines are wee babies, and some will grow in like a silver birch tree to higher than someone's house. But at the time, they all look about the same. And I suppose the majority of purchases, people just love the look of something, and they maybe don't read the label that says, you know, grows to 10 meters. Or they're wanting something tall and they don't read the label that says only goes to 10 centimetres.
Yeah, sometimes as gardeners, we're not very good at reading labels, are we? We just the look of something.
Yeah, absolutely.
So you said at the beginning you are in New Hopeton Gardens 3 days a week now. So when you're not there, I know you're involved in lots of other things. And one of the things that you're involved with is Discover Scottish Gardens, where you're one of the directors. Discover Scottish Gardens is a membership organisation and it focuses on promoting gardens for the public to visit across Scotland. So for listeners who may not be familiar with that organisation, would you like to talk a wee bit more, Dougal, about it?
I find marketing is a very exciting activity. You know, how do you tell people about what's going on and let them discover things that they wouldn't know otherwise? And we've got over 120 gardens as members of Discover Scottish Gardens. And it's up to Discover Scottish Gardens to help market those gardens so that visitors can find them and go and support them. Because, you know, running a garden is expensive. If you're a nursery or a garden centre, you make your money by selling plant. But if you're a garden open to the public, you'll make a lot of your money by the tickets that they have to buy to get in. And we have a map that's produced each year with all 120 gardens plotted on it and a website that contains all that information and actively sends out social media promotions for different times of the year. I mean, we've just finished the big promotion for snowdrops, which starts the season off. And then as we move forward, you know, I suppose the peak of garden visiting is when the weather's good in May, June, July, August. But even in the winter, it's great to visit some gardens. Leslie and I were over near Stranraer a couple of weeks ago and went to Glen Wham. There's no one else there. There was an honesty box, the ticket office that we put our entry fee into. And it had been a drizzly morning, a sort of West Coast drizzle. And as we arrived, the sun broke out And it was just majestic. And it was a garden that was fantastic to visit in January. The sun on the evergreen conifers and the coloured stems of dogwoods and willow was just wonderful. And they have two stretches of water there. And so the reflections in the water were just memorable. And we had the place to ourselves. And if a garden's good to visit at that time of year, just think what it's going to be like at peak seasons when, you know, all the flowers are appearing on things. You know, I can't recommend a garden like that too much.
That's magical, as you say, having it to yourself. So that was in January. Do you think there are particular times of year when gardens in Scotland are then at their best to visit? Or is it very much garden dependent?
I think it actually depends on the garden visitors. What time do they want to go out? Because, you know, garden visiting, I suppose there's sort of two different sorts of people. People who just love going out with family or friends to a lovely place, chatting, maybe talking about some of the what they're seeing is just a great outing. So, you know, at snowdrop weekends, a lot of the public just love to go out and to be out, especially after a long winter. It's great. And then you get the other guys, which is a bit like my wife, Leslie, and myself, who may be garden bores, and we just love garden visiting. And our families generally wouldn't want to go with us because we'll be pointing, oh, look at that snowdrop, that one's different from that one. Although we're not really galanthophiles, but, you know, we know a lot about plants and are always excited to see things we'd forgotten about growing. And we'll go at any time of year. Certainly the peak time is the summer when it's nice to be out. But for garden visitors, any month of the year is just a great time to get out.
I can relate to that, Dougal. I've been known to leave my husband and children in the car in a car park while I've gone for a visit around a garden because they have point blankly refused to get out of the vehicle.
Yes, I used to take my daughter on holiday for a week each summer, and there was always a deal that 3 days we'd visit gardens and 4 days we'd be in shopping places for her. And that worked really well. And I didn't get too bored while she was looking at things. She wouldn't even be buying anything, just doing this girly look at things and touching things. And
yeah. You mentioned that Discover Scottish Gardens produces a physical map, and that's a fantastic tool to have in your hands to be able to plot your route around Scotland and through all of these wonderful gardens. So how can listeners pick up a Discover Scottish Gardens map?
Well, if they're finding difficulty, I mean, they can go on the website and the detail is there as well. But I agree with you, to have a physical map, it's a bit like sat-nav, isn't it? You don't really know where you are. But if you have the whole map of Scotland, you can see clusters of gardens. All the member gardens, the 120, will have supplies of the maps that you can pick up. And a lot of the tourist racks of what to do in the area, particularly the landmark ones, they're always topped up with the maps. And in fact, Landmark said last year that our brochure, our map, was one of the most popular ones that they were filling up most often. It's quite a big map, so you only get 10 in a rack. So it can run out quite quickly and be having to wait for the top up the next week. But keep your eyes open. They're very distinctive. They sort of purple colour with lovely images. This year it's going to be pink roses on the front.
And you see, there is a website. So if you haven't got the physical map, you can go onto the website and you can find out more about all of the individual gardens. But what you mentioned there is quite key as well, clusters of gardens, because that can involve a day or a weekend. And you might think, if I go to this area, what is there to visit? Well, you have a look on the website, have a look on the Discover Scottish Gardens map and find some clusters of gardens together, which would quite easily and happily fill a weekend.
Yeah, Leslie and I, 18 months ago, drove up to the Moray Firth and had a lovely time looking at Gordon Castle, Cawdor Castle, Logie Steddings, and of course, we took tea in Munro's Garden Centre in the Black Isle, as one does, and then moved over to the west and had a lovely visit to Attardale. Attardale has its own railway station, amazingly, right in the middle of nowhere. And then we escaped to Skye, and it wasn't as busy as we feared, and just fell in love with Dunvegan Castle. And you know, when you look at the map, well, that's how we planned it. We saw the cluster of dots on the map. And, you know, there are clusters down in the borders, all around Skye, there's lots. And as you say, it's almost slow tourism, isn't it? That you just don't go to an area to visit one garden, but you go somewhere where you can stay for a couple of nights and explore the area and of course, three or four different gardens.
And it's really important to see and to be inspired by gardens, but to see what grows well in different areas.
Yeah, and at different times of year. And, you know, we're always learning something. I mean, some of the frustrations can be, you know, not being able to find out the name. I haven't tried one of these apps on my phone yet because I think I know a lot of plants. But Leslie pointed at a blue clematis. She wanted to know the name. She's a great fan of clematis. And it came back, blue clematis, which wasn't very helpful. But I think it was accurate, but it didn't really help us very much.
Yeah, that doesn't help you going to try and find that plant to buy.
No.
Do you have favourite gardens to visit across Scotland when you have time to do it? Do you go back to the same gardens again and again, or is the thrill in discovering new gardens?
I think it's both. You know, the gardens you love, because they change with the seasons, and also they change as plants get bigger, or, you know, sadly, if the wind's taken a few trees out, then suddenly it's opened up an area so that your next visit is quite different. The one we probably always visited most is Branklin, just outside Perth, in the National Trust garden. And it's just a small garden, but there's always something exciting to see at every time of year or year round. We look out onto the Dales stately home, which is part of the National Trust, House of the Bins. And their grounds are open all year round. And it's a lovely walk for us to walk up the hill and round the garden. You get fantastic views from the folly right in the middle of the garden. And, of course, at snowdrop time, the hillside is just a mass of snowdrops, just sheets and sheets of snowdrops. And I think whether you're a keen gardener or just like getting out into the countryside, it's those sheets of white snowdrops that impress you. You don't need to go around and look at the individual flowers. It's just that huge impact. And it's, you know, it's your first afternoon out after the new year. And, oh, you know, it's memorable. You remember it for weeks and weeks afterwards. And you talk about it to other people and, you know, you must go. Have you forgotten about it? It's open now.
Yeah, and a good garden will leave that lasting impression on you.
Yeah, absolutely.
So when you don't have your Discover Scottish Gardens hat on, you are chairing the Board of Trustees at Scotland's Garden Scheme, which also promotes garden openings across Scotland.
Yes, people sometimes get a little confused, but we work together because the gardening is that sort of community. But the Scotland's Garden Scheme, its job is to promote and support the opening of gardens, a lot of them individual gardens, that aren't open apart from under the Garden Scheme opening maybe once or twice a year. And the whole point of it is to raise money for charity, where and it's split between the garden owner's choice of charity and our three core partner charities, who we give money to. Whereas Discover Scottish Gardens is a marketing organisation, really to promote gardens that are open most of the year to garden visitors. And, you know, we're very compatible with each other. It's interesting. I was invited to apply to be chairman of the Scotland's Garden Scheme a couple of years ago. And I think in my life, I always thought that no one would employ me. I was being unemployable. And I think that's why I've always been self-employed. I didn't have the confidence. And I've only ever had two interviews for a job.
Wow.
The first one was to join the Council of the Royal Horticultural Society. And the second one was to stand to be chair of Scotland's garden scheme. And amazingly, I got both the jobs. But as Leslie said, yeah, but Dougal, neither of them pay. They're all voluntary jobs. So I've stayed self-employed.
But you passed both interviews with flying colours, obviously.
Well, yeah, I hope that's what they thought.
So when you go to visit a garden, Dougal, you also wear another hat because you're an IRHS-trained judge. Is it difficult then to set that aside when you visit a garden? Or are you always thinking, oh, that's a lovely planting combination, or oh, that design's worked very well, or the opposite, like, oh, that's terrible?
Both those things, I think. You know, we have very strict criteria when we're judging show gardens that we have to measure the show garden up against and score it. And actually visiting a garden without any responsibilities is quite a treat. You know, you haven't got to concentrate unless you want to. But even though we like visiting gardens together, I'm quite happy to have a little time on my own just to get the feel of the garden and to get the flow of it and see what the garden attracts me to go and look at. Which way am I going to go around it? And just let it wash over me. So, and then we'll get together and we might be a bit analytical on bits and pieces of it, just as, you know, professional stimulation. But generally, I just love visiting gardens. And there is an element, I suppose, of going back to old friends, but also slightly garden bagging, you know, and you know you've heard about gardens and you want to click them off. And, you know, one year we had 2 weeks in Madeira, which is a sort of favourite holiday place of us because it's never too hot and you can fly direct from Edinburgh and there's no time difference. So it ticks a lot of boxes. And that year we'd taken a lovely big glossy book of the gardens of Madeira with us. And in the 2 weeks, we visited 14 gardens.
Wow.
You know, which we wouldn't recommend to non-gardeners, but it was really exciting. It was a great project. And the only drawback, of course, is if you're the driver, you can't go and have a glass of wine in a garden. You have to wait for the evening. But then Madeira has such lovely eating places and drinking places. So come the evening, it's all great. And you've got great memories of the gardens you visited that day.
And you're very lucky then that Leslie also likes visiting gardens because you both want to do the same thing.
Yes.
So you first started garden judging back at the Glasgow Garden Festival.
Yes.
In 1988.
I was put forward to be a judge for the Horticultural Trades Association. So I was only 25 and the oldest judge was 85. I think the next oldest from me was 55. And so I was actually lucky working with some of the most eminent horticulturalists in Scotland, which was a great learning curve. But we had a garden there called the Life and Loves of Hardy Perennials. And I also said, well, I can't judge my own garden. They said, oh, no, it doesn't matter. Just stand aside and they'll judge it without you. And they never said anything about it to me. And we had three lots of judging of a couple of days each time. And at the end, our garden got the prize for the best use of plant material at the show. And they'd never told me what they thought about it at all. Yeah. That was a great experience.
And that obviously whet your appetite because you continued to judge gardens. And most recently, we saw you in Scotland to judge the Scottish Garden Design Competition last year at Scouten Palace Garden Fair.
Yeah, that was a great privilege. And we were amazed at how fantastic these little gardens were. Because the small garden is much harder to design than a big one. A big one, you can have faults and mistakes, whether it's at a show or whether it's in your own garden. And you can have areas that are not so good or maybe a bit wild, which might be a good thing for wildlife. But a small garden, everything's got to work really hard and all be in proportion and sit comfortably. And those gardens, 10 of them, oh, it was just such an honour to judge them. So we Leslie and I shortlisted the ones that are going forward this year. And the poor designers now will be panicking as, will their plants grow? Will they flower? Will they be big enough? We can't wait to see them at the beginning of June at Goon Palace.
As you say, it was quite nice to see smaller gardens, which actually people could take inspiration from and maybe recreate in their own garden space because they were 2.4 metres squared.
Yeah, they're all realistic. Exit surveys of visitors at Chelsea, for instance, always say they get more ideas from the small gardens because they can relate to them. The big ones are big showpieces, showstoppers, but very few of us would ever attempt or could afford, you know, to spend £250,000 on our gardens. And the small ones is where the inspiration is.
Yeah. And if you do have £250,000 to spend on your garden, come and spend it in New Hopton Gardens, because I'm sure you'll get excellent advice from you.
Definitely.
So how do you juggle everything you're involved in, Dougal? So running the nursery, being a director in Discover Scottish Gardens and chairing the Board of Trustees at Scotland's Garden Scheme, and time then in your own garden?
Well, am I allowed to say red wine?
Absolutely. whatever gets you through.
You know, red wine is actually very good for my health. You know, it's got so many good vitamins in it, and it's roughly fiber, you know, for your body. I'm very good at relaxing and going to sleep or reading a book. And you just keep a note of things that you're meant to be doing, so you don't let anyone down. But, it's such good fun to get out into our garden. We both love our garden. It's not too big, so we manage to keep on top of it. We generally don't garden in the same space. We'll both have different projects on, which is quite compatible. And then you can go and see what Leslie's done. Oh, and she can come and see the mess I've made. And she's quite good at clearing up or helping to clear up my mess, which is always a delight. Because our garden is really our laboratory. And it's where we learn about new plants and ways of pruning things and how successful things can be. So, there's no, apart from bad wet weather, there's nothing to stop you going out to the garden, because there's always something new to learn and to see, and to see how things are developing. So I don't know. It's just a way of life. I mean, you'll be the same.
So is that your top tip then for couples who garden together, is to have separate areas in which to work?
No, I don't think you necessarily. I mean, that is quite common. And someone will maybe do the vegetables and someone will do the flower garden. We do a bit of everything. I tend to always cut the grass, and Leslie does more in the potager than I do, but it's quite good to chop and change so it doesn't become territorial and you don't have to have any arguments. And you know, Leslie has about 100 pots in the garden, so occasionally I'll water them for her or move them around. So compatible but not competitive.
Well, that's good. We had a husband and wife on the podcast together right back in series one, and their advice was to stay apart. They had separate projects and they found that was the best way of working together.
Yeah.
Everyone's different.
Yeah.
So all guests of the podcast to go are asked about choosing just three plants. So if you could only have three plants in a garden. And it's so interesting for listeners to find out from very experienced gardeners like yourself, which three plants would you choose and why would you choose them?
Oh, that's a beastly question, MT, because every month you have a favourite, don't you? But you warned me you were going to ask about this, so I thought about it. And I think a small tree is really important in the garden, particularly as we're all becoming aware that we maybe shouldn't sit in the sun too much, so a bit of shade's a good idea. And of all the small trees we've got in our garden, I think it's the winter flowering cherry, Prunus subhortella autumnalis rosea, the pink one. I find the white blossom is a little bit messy, and it starts flowering between November right through till March. And this year was really weird because it didn't offer any flowers really until the beginning of February. And it's just completely covered with them. the whole of February before the blossom starts falling. And at Christmas time, Leslie likes to hang lots of little fairy lights over it. It's at the entrance to our courtyard from their car park. And it's just a good structural thing. I think it's some evergreens in the garden to give us some all-year-round interest. And it's hard to look beyond the golden choicea sundance. And I first saw that in a trial bed at Blooms of Bressingham many, many years ago, before it was launched onto the market. It's proved really hardy. We have it on a windy corner, which always amazed us it would survive. Lovely white flowers in May. The leaves, if you crush them, have got a very strong smell, not to everyone's taste. And my final third one is a shrub or climbing rose called May Gold. And it's a lovely golden full flower. We have it trained up a big, heavy wooden post, and we wrap it around the post so it flowers all the way up. It has a fantastic flowering late May, as its name would suggest, and then it's always offering a few flowers right until September. And maybe I can cheat, because we have a clematis tiara, which is a form of the orange peel clematis growing up it. And it's one you cut down to sort of 45 centimeters, 18 inches at this time of year. And then it completely covers the post and the rose with these lovely yellow flowers for weeks and weeks in September and October. So those would be my three.
Oh, those are lovely choices, Dougal. And I'm delighted with the Choicea Sundance choice, because I'm trying to mentally count up. I think I have five of them in the garden. And yes, it's a favourite too, because it's a good all-round doer.
Yeah, yeah. And it does respond to pruning if it gets too big, which is always, you know, a great thing. Because some people, believe it or not, are scared of plants getting too big.
Well, I have one that's, I don't know why this year of all years, it's been in the ground for 10, 12 years. It just seems to have been battered by the prevailing wind this year, and it's leaning quite badly. So that's one that's going to need some TLC this year.
Yep, a hard chop, and don't panic. And 6 weeks' time, it'll have lovely new growth on it.
Yeah, they're good ones. So what would be then, for anyone listening, Dougal, the best piece of gardening advice that you would give to new gardeners, given that you've had a lifetime in gardening?
I think the most important thing, whether it's an established garden that you've moved into or whether it's a brand new garden, is take your time. If it's an established one, learn what's there. Learn what the sun does, what the wind does, what the views from the house are. So don't rush in too quickly. But the first thing to do really quickly is make sure you've got somewhere to sit. And if you haven't got much money, even just some gravel, so that it's a clean, dry place to sit. I think if it's, well, actually, if you know someone who's got a new garden, whether they're established or not, the great housewarming is to give them a big pot with a shrub and two or three perennials in it that they can enjoy immediately. They don't have to make a new flower bed. But eventually, once they've learnt about the garden, they can take them out of the pot and plant them permanently in the ground. So take your time. But also those views from the house, particularly in the winter, when we're not at home in the daylight as much as in the summer, the view from the house is so important. And just make sure out of every window that overlooks your garden, you've got a great view to look at.
That's great advice, Dougal, because so many people design their garden based on being in the middle of the garden. But if you have lots of windows or patio doors and you're overlooking the garden, it's important to make sure that you have something beautiful to look on.
Yeah, and we do, as we recommend, we've got five doors into the garden with a view on each point of the compass. So they work hard for us.
And that entices you out into the garden.
And even if you don't go, it still invites you. And you know, if you've got a seat as part of your view, you just imagine yourself sitting there on the seat even when it's got 4 inches of snow sitting on it.
That's a lovely thought to have. Well, Dougal, thank you so very much for making time today to chat with us on the Scotland Grow Show. I'll link in the show notes to New Hopetoun Gardens, Discover Scottish Gardens and Scotland's Garden Scheme so people can find out more about all of the things that you've talked about today. And hopefully our chat will inspire people to go out and find some really fabulous gardens across Scotland, maybe in areas where you've never been before, to just go and be inspired by other people's gardens.
Well, thank you for having me, MT. It's been great.
See you soon, Dougal. Thank you so much.
Lovely. Thank you very much.
Thank you for tuning in to another episode of the Scotland Grows Show. Don't forget to follow us on social media by searching for Scotland Grows across Facebook, Instagram or LinkedIn, and sign up for our mailing list at scotlandgrowsmagazine.com so you never miss an episode of the Scotland Grows Show. And if you're not yet subscribed to receive Scotland Grows magazine, 6 times a year, straight to your inbox, literally packed with Scottish gardening goodness, then be sure to do so as soon as possible, and you'll even get access to all the back issues. Details can be found on our website at scotlandgrowsmagazine.com, across our social media feeds, and in the show notes for this episode. The information on National Trust for Scotland's Roots subscription is also in the show notes, and they would appreciate your support to help National Trust for Scotland's gardens and design landscapes thrive. I look forward to you joining me on the next episode of the Scotland Grows Show as we celebrate Scottish gardening.